On the Empire Podcast this week, Luke Evans stops trying to kill Smaug for 5 minutes and heads to the pod booth to talk about becoming the latest big screen Dracolier. While do you hear? Dr. William Weir himself, aka Sam Neill, also slips into the pod booth to talk Peaky Blinders, all that and the usual movie news and nonsense. On the movie podcast, I would love to help Terry Quattro slip in our new light bulb. Anytime you like, Terry. Anytime you like. That sounded ruder than intended.
It sounded about as rude as you intended.
I intended it to be very rude.
It was pretty rude.
Okie dokes. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Now, we're recording this on Thursday, October 2nd, National Poetry Day. Someone has said it's National Poetry Day, so therefore it is. So I've decided to introduce my three colleagues of such lethal cunning this week via the medium of verse. And you thought this podcast couldn't get any worse. Never read the comments. First up, he's jolly and convivial and the king of all things cinematic and trivial. When you find the answer just doesn't want to come, you know you've just met Ali Plum.
Did you know that Newman was often mistaken for Marlon Brando when he was early on in his career? And he used to just sign Marlon Brando best wishes.
Really?
Because he didn't want to burst their bubble.
That's amazing. Did you just make that up? That's a real fact?
Yes.
My word. You're a walking compendium. All right, here's another one. Kneel, you dogs! Kneel, I say! Your geek queen is here, and here to stay! Her dragons rage, from Croydon to Connemara. Swear your allegiance to Helen O'Hara!
thank you. I feel like your scansion needs a little bit of work there, a little tweaking, perhaps. But you know, real power there, real passion in
well,
your delivery.
Didn't I?
Great
yeah.
Delivery. Good. So, yeah, carry on.
Excellent. Is this the first time you've ever had a poem written about you?
Oh, I've had many, many. No,
yeah, I've read the graffiti. Many.
Tweet in your poems to at empiremagazine.com.
Yes, please do.
If you'd like to say something about any one of us.
All right, here's the last one. On an island green where raptors claw and T-Rexes stuff goats into their mighty maw, that's where you'll find him most of the time. This Jurassic Park fan with a surname that's bloody well nigh on impossible to rhyme. It's Nick Dissemblian.
C minus. You're like Dr. Seuss's crap twin. But thank you very much for the poem.
It took me 5 minutes to do that. Mm. Oh, thanks, guys. By the way, I was channeling Richard Burton doing Under Milk Wood there.
Really? I never would have guessed.
Don't know if you gathered that.
I thought it was Luke Evans.
Sky guys!
Come on.
All right, here we go. Here's a question from at John C.N. Harris. Who's the most punchable movie protagonist? Sounds like a great Empire podcast question. Yes, it is. Can't wait to hear it. Nick, how did this come about?
Well, this came about, I watched Nightcrawler the other night, which is a phenomenal film, but it features Jake Gyllenhaal as the most annoying. I'm not sure annoying is the right word.
No.
You just actually want to kill him. He's kind of evil without really breaking the law, and he's just a horrible, vile, ghoulish kind of character. So I came out and tweeted something about wanting to punch him repeatedly.
Lou Bloom.
We'll
be discussing that film in a month or so.
How about that? Yeah.
The marketing campaign has been quite clever because they've been all the emails have been from Lou Bloom.
Yes.
Lou Bloom.
There we go.
And there's a couple of really nice posters out there for it. Do check it out.
So Nick then tweeted that he wanted to punch Lou Bloom. And then John C. Harris said, who's the most punchable movie protagonist? Nick, you started this whole bandwagon rolling.
Well, I hate to cut this short, but I have the correct answer.
Okay.
I'm just going to say two words. Mariska Hargitay. It is, of course, the Love Guru. How can anyone be more punchable than the Love Guru?
The Riot Club, the whole of the Riot Club.
Okay,
pretty
I haven't
punchable.
Seen that.
I mean, genuinely, they need a punch. They use the word mate in that film to mean about 16 different things, most of which are insults.
Oh my, wow. It's such a bunch of bloody, ruddy, awful chunderbuses. They're awful. I hate them.
Mate.
They're meant to be awful, aren't they?
They are, but they really are. So they get.
Do any of them at any point say Mariska Hargitay?
Repeatedly for
That's
2
true.
Hours.
They don't. They
isn't
don't.
Isn't that the film's greatest joke when he goes Mariska Hargitay, Mariska Hargitay, and she turns up in a cameo?
Our colleague Dan memorably referred to that film as a laugh necropolis, which is spot on.
Howard the Duck.
Oh, he's on my list as well.
He'd get a punch right in the bill. And I think he'd like it because he's dirty like that. I would also suggest, and this is another, well, is this really a protagonist when he's kind of playing himself? But James Franco as James Franco in This Is The End would get a solid fist-in-mouth connection delivered by me.
Mm. That seems fair. Yeah, mm-hmm. that seems fair. Mm-hmm. There are quite a lot of them out there. I mean, I remember I was having a discussion on, I think, Twitter a few months ago about the punchability of Paul Dano. Now, he is, by all accounts, an absolutely lovely man. However, he does have a face...
Oh, come on now. Well, no, I know what Helen's saying.
He plays characters, let's say, who yeah. have faces who you want to punch.
Or hit smack with a bowling pin. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not to, you know, not to the extent that Daniel Plainview did, because, hey, kids, violence, it's bad, don't do it.
It is bad.
But I mean, even I thought Ruby Sparks was somewhat, you know, weakened by the fact that I just didn't get behind him at any point because I wanted to punch him.
Yeah, this is an interesting question, I think, because there are lots of people in movie history. We've talked about this. I think we've actually talked about our favourite movie punches in the podcast in the past. You know, and a lot of people who deserve to get punched, get punched. So Richard Thornburg, William Atherton's character in Die Hard, gets punched, deservedly so. But there are a lot of people, I think, who don't get punched, who really, really need one. Frodo.
No.
Frodo needs a massive fist in the
kisser. What are you saying?
He carries
a ring of power. Bloody. Across yeah. Middle Earth.
And he doesn't shut up about it. Oh, Sam, my burden, oh, it's so heavy, Sam. Punch him in the face.
I can't believe
that's
what
not
I'm
a
hearing.
Dread quote, by the way. But,
you are worse than Sauron.
Mr. Frodo, give me your face. There you go. Done. Give me that bloody ring. Movie over. We can all go home now.
Grab a bird. Let's go.
Grab a bird.
I would also suggest Max from Rushmore. He's a totally.
Oh, God, yes.
Totally head in curb. Job.
Yes.
He's a real. I mean, Wes Anderson's movies are full of these. You could also say the Royal of Royal Tenenbaums, after pretending to have cancer to get close with his kids, could be you know, worthy of a knuckle sandwich. Also, I want to suggest, although he's not a lead character and it's not a real film, but but Mark Williams might get a, I would say, kneecap to the jaw.
Ooh.
Who?
Mutt.
Mutt
Williams.
AKA Mutt Jones. AKA the real Indiana Jones.
Genuinely didn't know who that character was for a second. I was going, what?
I don't understand. Okay. I don't remember him from any of the three Indiana Jones films. So
this joke was brought to you from 1999.
I think we could punch this joke into the ground. But no, genuinely, I was a bit worried about that one. I'm not an advocate of punching children. I
like where this is going.
I don't normally back it. I don't normally throw my weight behind it. But, you know, Kevin from Home Alone, punch him.
Oh, I thought you
I'm
were going
to. I'm siding with the burglars.
I thought you were going to say Last Airbender.
Anyone in The Last Airbender. Anyone involved in The Last Airbender.
I think Richie Rich might actually get a.
Richie Rich more than Kevin, actually. Although Kevin is a junior psychopath. Like, I think that. I genuinely think that movie
I
is
had that
more dangerous.
When I was younger.
That movie is more dangerous for kids than any Reservoir Dogs or any of that nonsense. Reservoir Dogs shows that the consequences of violence are bad. You bleed horribly and die. Home Alone shows that you can drop a heated iron on a man's face from a great height and he'll just have a comedy mark. You know, it's not a great message for kids or indeed humans.
Hey, James Bond learned everything he knows from Kevin from Home Alone.
And he's a psycho as well.
You'd like to punch James Bond, wouldn't you?
I would like to punch James Bond.
To be fair, he has been punched a few times.
Usually hit in the back of the head, isn't he? I remember you guys noticing when you watched
them
all back to back.
You can sneak up at James Bond very, very easily. I'm going to throw in Edward Furlong as John Connor in Terminator 2, a movie I love, but my God, that brat needs slapped. And Charlie Chaplin.
What?
Just punch him.
No.
Punch that
with a bread roll.
Oh, my. Yeah, punch him with a bread roll.
Bread roll on each fist.
People punch him all the time. That's his problem. It's so unfair.
He needs a good punching. Next question is from at Darren Hinchy, who says, what's the best use of a real film in a film? E.g., The Quiet Man in E.T.
That is good. I think the best use is Cinema Paradiso. It's the wheel of kisses at the end. It's brilliant. That would be the best one.
Well, that's just cheating, isn't it?
Yes, by having the right answer.
It's about a cinema. That's just cheating.
No, but they play the reel of excised kisses from all these films that have been censored from all these films. They play it together at the end, and it's gorgeous.
That is a good one.
How about the Sonny Chiba double bill, triple bill in True Romance?
Very good.
I know one of my friends has actually done that.
Really?
He's actually watched those films in that order because he loves True Romance so much.
Good for him.
Was he then chased down by the mob?
I haven't heard from him for ages.
Was there a lady in a neon green bra at any point?
a prostitute? I don't know. I'll find out.
Ask him.
Probably.
Ask him. Better Tomorrow 2 pops up in True Romance as well.
You love that.
I do love that.
In a movie called Sleepless in Seattle.
That's on my list too.
There is a movie called An Affair to Remember Black.
It's a Blaffair to Remember Black.
Blaffair to Remember Black. No, there's obviously, it's a silly girls film, I think.
Oh my God.
Someone calls it. In the movie, not me. It's a movie based on that movie and they play with it, so it's pretty good.
It's often the geekiest directors who cram other movies into the film. So obviously Edgar Wright, the Bad Boys 2, Point Break, Double Bill in the middle of Hot Fuzz, and Joe Dante is really good at it.
Yeah,
pretty much all his films have got other films popping up. Obviously Gizmo watching Rambo First Blood in Gremlins 2. There's Just Watch the Burbs, where Tom Hanks is freaking out while there's sort of a montage of different horror films playing on the TV.
Race of the Devil and The Exorcist. And
yeah. And then obviously Snow White, Wonderful Life. Tons.
I think we mentioned Shawshank Redemption most times, don't we?
Yeah.
Gilda, isn't it?
Shout out to The Shining in the classic Twister, Dumbo in 1941, and of course Halloween at the beginning of Scream. Am I right?
Am I right?
Yes, your expression.
No,
sorry.
I was trying to think of something else. No, not at the beginning of the screen, but towards the end when they're watching Halloween at whose house is it? I can't remember whose house, but they're watching Halloween, and then at one point Randy is left watching on his own while Ghostface is behind him and he's yelling out at the TV, and they all get very, very excited about it.
I'm surprised no one's mentioned Log Jammin' from The Big Lebowski, because that is a real film, right?
That is a real film. That is absolutely
I certainly wouldn't want to be the one to tell you otherwise.
You've had that on your rental list on Amazon Instant for a while, and it just hasn't arrived yet.
Just if you can find it, just, you know where I tweet.
Good questions this week. Here's the last one. This is via email from Stephen Fairbanks, who asks, "Hello, Pod. I was watching Gone Girl last night, which I very much enjoyed, and I wondered, in terms of directorial quality, what's the most dependable first name for a director? I thought the answer was obviously David, i.e. Fincher, Lynch, Lean, Cronenberg, but can you think of any other names? Any other Davids, first of all?"
Yes, David O. Russell.
David O. Russell, David Lowry, who did Ain't Them Body Saints. Mm-hmm. Any other Davids?
Sure, lots.
Lots of Davids. Well done, Davids.
I have an interesting spin-off thing from this. I was thinking, how many individual first names are used just to define a single director? So, here are some examples. You know who I'm talking about when I say
McGee.
Ridley, Clint, Woody, Quentin, Walt, Orson, Buster, Hayao. It's just interesting how there are these one-off, Woody, right, yeah, I get it. But in terms of answering this question, Billy or William or Will, because you've got William Wilder, William Wyler, William Friedkin, Bill Condon, Bill Forsyth, and he's only done two movies and they haven't been that good, but Billy Bob Thornton.
Bill Paxton directed as
Bill
well.
Bill Paxton, yes, Frailty. Stick it in there.
Good movie. I'm firmly in the John camp. we got McTiernan, we got Ford, we got Woo, we got Waters, we got Hughes, we got Landis. Beat that.
That's Carpenter.
Very solid.
Carpenter.
That's a big camp.
That's a huge camp. Camp David.
I was going to say Steven, just because you get Spielberg and Soderbergh and then you just rest your case, really. Is that Steven with a V? Sorry, Steven, who asked the question. Spike, pretty dependable. Not very many of them.
But good.
A really good hitting ratio for those who
Jones,
who
Lee. Spike. Anyone else? Any other Spikes?
I've basically got Jones and Lee.
Spike the dog from Tom and Jerry. Did he make anything?
Takashi?
Yes. Also up there.
Gus.
Wes's Craven and Anderson.
That's true.
George. Okay.
Romero.
Clooney. Lucas. Pal. And Romero. Not bad.
That's good.
Not a bad little
Kukor as well.
Kukor, yeah. Thank you.
We're forgetting the obvious one. Ingmar. God, how many of them?
Yeah.
Ingmar Smith, Jones, Wesson, Winchester.
Are you just naming guns now?
Colt, Ingmar Colt, he was good.
Ingmar Shotgun,
he was good. Yeah, Bergman,
Gatling,
Batman. Yeah, all the Ingmars.
Swordfish,
all of them. Sam Fuller, Sam Peckinpah.
I'm going to represent the Kens. We got Branagh, we got Loach, we got Russell, we got Burns, and best of all, we got Ken Corder.
Bloody Corder.
Oh yeah,
good work.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I actually think Ken was a very good pull from deep within your memory bag.
Mm-hmm.
Hats off to you.
Strong.
Michael, there's some Michaels. Cimino.
Uh-huh.
Presburger, Powell, one of them.
Powell.
Powell.
Michael Powell.
You've got, let's see, Mike Newell.
Winterbottom.
Yes.
Mike Winterbottom.
Yes.
Corleone.
Spielberg.
In between 2 and 3, he made lots of films.
I'm not sure we've come up with a really scientific.
It's not scientific.
I think Will, John, here. And George are good shouts.
I think John was good. All right, thank you for your questions. If you want to have your question read out in the podcast, and why the hell would you? But if you do, do tweet us. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. Facebook us. Empire Magazine is what we are on Facebook. And you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Right, okie dokie. Time now for our first interview of the pod, which sees Luke Evans return to the booth. The last time the Welsh actor was here, he was talking about his supporting role in The Desolation of Smaug as Bard the Bowman, the ace archer who was last seen being spied on by Stephen Colbert. But now he's up front and centre as the latest big screen incarnation of Dracula in, yes, Dracula Untold, which is an origin tale showing how Vlad the Impaler became a monstrous sucker, bloodsucker. Evans came along recently to talk to myself and Ali Bloody Plum. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined in the Empire Pod booth by Luke Evans, star of Dracula Untold. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. How's it going?
I'm not too bad. Yourself?
Yeah, marvellous. Very good. Very happy to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. Good to be walking abroad during the day, I imagine.
Yes, with a big glasses, sunglasses. Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of Factor 800.
Yes. Yes. Factor 800.
The usual stuff. For when you started, when you got this role and you were looking at doing research for it, did you go to a documentary by Christopher Lee called In Search of Dracula, in which he explores the myth, the legend of Vlad the Impaler.
Is he in it, or is it just his voice?
He just narrates. He appears on camera, but he narrates it.
I might have seen it. I saw a hell of a lot of documentaries. I mean, YouTube is full of them. Mm-hmm. And some of them are really interesting. So I could have seen it. I might have seen it. But it was a while ago now, so I can't remember. I'm hopefully going to meet Christopher Lee at Christmas at the premiere of The Hobbit, so I'm very excited about that.
Oh my God, that's going to be amazing.
I thought for a second you said I was going to meet Dracula.
Yeah. Well, I am going to meet Dracula in a way, aren't I? Yeah, and he's going to meet Dracula too.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great.
You can compare
notes. Is that possible? Are we allowed to be in the same room at the same time?
I think so.
That's a whole lot of darkness.
Just make sure you're both wearing capes.
Yeah. Yeah, but he was a count and I'm a prince. Mm. That's the difference. I'm a prince in this one.
Can you, I'm confused by how that works. Can you get promoted to become a count from a prince? How does that work?
I don't know. I think he might become a count later on in his life after he'd become full vamp. So, I don't know. Obviously, this film, you see the man. The man, that's who you start with. You start with the human being. So he's Prince Vlad, the real human being, the historical figure that walked this earth in the 1400s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a very different story to the Bram Stoker one that most people will be assuming this is, but it's not. It's completely different.
But how do you find a way into that? Because Vlad the Impaler, as the name might suggest, was given to impaling people on things, and there's a general, I'd imagine, darkness to that character. But this Vlad is much more of a romantic hero, dashing type.
The beginning of the film, there's an introduction to the history of who he is, and you see that he was reared as a child. His father gave him and his brother away to as a sort of peace treaty to the first Sultan of the Turkish Empire. And it was sort of, he was, those boys were then reared as Turkish warriors, as royal hostages, but they were taught all these torture techniques. And then Vlad obviously came back to reclaim his throne as a teenager, as a young man. And in our film, you know, he puts that person to bed. He puts that character away. He locks the door in the dungeon and that armor is put away and he then reigns over a peaceful land, which he also did for 10 years. There was peace in the country, was called Wallachia. Not many people know about that, but yeah. And then, you know, it all starts to go tits up. I can say that. And you know, he digs out this. Well, the armor comes second. The first thing that comes is this search for power.
Yeah.
And he goes right to the darkest point he could go. The darkest, dirtiest place he could find, and he finds this ominous creature played by Charles Dance, brilliantly portrayed by Charles Dance, and acquires these powers. But obviously with these powers comes much worse things. So,
Were you given the power to call him Charlie? Because I know that's an important thing.
People do call him Charlie. I didn't call him Charlie. I was only with him for 4 days. I thought I'd just better keep it polite.
And when he had those massive nails...
The nails. It's interesting because in the scene where he touches my face with the nails, you can just hear the nails scraping over my stubble. if you listen very closely, you can hear it. And he taps my face. he worked with those nails very well. It was quite cool.
But he's a good guitar player as well, I can imagine, with those bad boys.
Yeah, he could probably, or a harpist. Yeah.
Famous vampires for being harpists. There's a lot of myth to this. Obviously, with any vampire movie, it's how it works, how it becomes. In this one, it's a very dramatic moment where you become a vampire. What's it like pretending to drink blood? From, I should point out, half a broken skull.
From half a broken skull. Yes, yeah, that was nice. That was lovely. Yeah, he cracks it the consistency is very, very similar to blood, I've been told. We sort of experimented. Well, I didn't. I didn't really have a choice in the matter. I just had to drink whatever they gave me. But we went from a mixture of beetroot juice and cherry juice to the pickups. It was then a very strong, sweet, sickly licorice syrup, which was blacker than it was earlier in the shoot. Obviously, being black, obviously because it was coming from the veins of a very old, decrepit, sinister master vampire. So. And that stuff was disgusting. It was absolutely disgusting. So when you see that face I'm making, it's because it's so disgustingly sickly sweet. And I had to drink so much of it. It was horrible, absolutely horrible. It looks good and it looks the right consistency. But
you suffer for your art.
Yeah. One does.
Is that an occasion where you're basically, I just want to nail this in one take. This is it. Or is Gary Shore basically... At that point, Kubrick
he's not a one-take director, unfortunately. The scene deserved a few more takes than that, so I was prepared to drink for a while. But it's a fantastic scene. It's very powerful. It's a landmark in the transition of Vlad's story, and you know that's the beginning of his transition into becoming the vampire. Mm. But it was a very powerful moment, and I think Charlie, as I like to call him, did a brilliant job. He was only in for like 4 days. Did that all in four
He's
days.
A pro.
He's a real pro. And as an actor who's only been in films for like 6 years, when you get to work opposite somebody like Charles, you're just like, this is I'm really lucky, you know? I'm really lucky. And he's got his face pressed up against mine, he's scratching my face. It's just like, this is awesome. I love it.
You also get to wear the suit of armor that you've alluded to, which has these glorious big dragon-like emblems. Like you look like an absolute tank. I hope you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's monstrous. Is there any chance you got to take it home? I know the answer is no.
The answer is no, and I didn't even try or attempt to. I mean, listen, when you've worn that for 4 months, and Gary Shore is asking you to do the most impossible moves in that armor. My whole torso was covered in bruised pinch marks from where I was having to just contort myself into shapes that are not meant for men in armor. I'm quite happy that I never see that armor again. I'm sure it'll end up in some glass cabinet somewhere in the Universal. A building somewhere in the world. It looks incredible, and that's the most important thing. I mean, it's incredibly dramatic, and it plays a very strong role because it's like he's putting on his old skin and he goes back to being the Impaler character, you know, this vicious, dark man who uses that person. He brings that person back to life along with his vampiric powers, which he's now acquired. So, yeah, it plays its role, and it's obviously become the star of the posters as well. I mean, it really stands out. It's amazing. Sure. It's incredible. It looks brilliant. Really brilliant.
It doesn't stand out quite as much as Dominic Cooper's gold armor. And I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but was it difficult to take him seriously?
Well, you have to remember, you probably don't remember because I had such little screen time in the film I'm about to explain. Clash of the Titans, which was my first ever movie, I played Apollo. And in the very small amount of time I'm on that screen, you will see that I'm in bright gold armor. So I had immense empathy for the boy. I didn't laugh at him. I didn't make him feel uncomfortable because I knew exactly what it feels like to look like C-3PO with a hat.
Fair enough.
You see this in the trailer, and it's that big kind of watch me moment in the trailer where you assembling a hundreds of thousands of bats,
yeah.
transform those bats into a massive fist, which has been everyone's daydream, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And then you slam it into, like, tens of thousands of Turks. When you were doing that, obviously, during the shoot, you were just, you know, punching the ground.
Yeah.
How did it feel to actually watch that on screen?
Well, I'm just glad all those broken knuckles, skin on my knuckles was worth it, frankly. I love that moment. I think it has... Excuse the pun, it's very impactful. I think it works brilliantly well. And it's what's lovely about it, and I'm being very philosophical here, but the fact that he uses bats goes back to not just Bram Stoker's story, it goes back to Eastern European folklore. Bats have always been associated with vampires. And the vampires always have had the power of these creatures. So the fact that he uses them to such an extent with such ability and like such power, I think it's great. It's honoring folklore from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, which I think is a brilliant thing. Yeah.
And you also, we were discussing this on the way down here. I don't think there's been a Dracula on screen that's killed more people than you.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he obliterates that army. Yeah. Well, they shouldn't have had their blindfolds on, frankly. Do you know what I mean?
in one scene alone.
Big mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you rack up a bigger body count in that one scene alone than Christopher Lee did in 7 films.
Well, there we go.
Which isn't too shabby.
I'll be reminding him of that at Christmas. Yeah. Over a sherry or two.
But because you're playing Vlad, I guess it's easier to throw off the shackles of history, because this is a role that has been played by multiple actors across multiple movies in nearly a century's worth of cinema.
Yeah.
But at the same time, are you conscious of that? And are you also, at the same time, trying to include little nods to Dracula's past, Lugosi and Lee and Oldman, people like that?
They're very present in my mind and were present from the second I said yes to the movie. And obviously, I not that they were a reference, really, because it was the Bram Stoker story that's been portrayed in film always. But it was nice to, for me, I think, as an actor, to just see the legacy of this character on screen and see the different actors and the different portrayals of this character over the decades. Mm. Almost 100 years it's been shown on the silver screen. So it was nice for me to go back and just made myself aware of what I was getting myself involved with and what baton I was actually picking up and responsibility that I had to give it something special and do something different with it. And I mean, the easy part was I was telling a completely different story, an origin story which hadn't been done. So I immediately felt like I could separate myself from that to an extent.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the end of the day, you know, I'm Dracula. I am the new Dracula. So I feel very lucky. I feel very honored. I feel very, I feel like I'm now part of a family of actors that have, you know, been going since 1932. So it's quite a privilege.
One thing you do, which I was pleased with, but I was also, it's a bit of a shame, is that you do an English kind of more received pronunciation.
Did you want me to do a Transylvanian accent?
There was a small part of me that wanted, I want to suck your blood.
That was obviously never going to happen in a million years. But would you tend
imagine
to do,
I would have had.
Can you imagine? Dracula.
Dracula.
Was that ever on the table?
I think once you've heard the brilliant Gary Oldman do his Transylvanian accent, I think we shouldn't go near it.
Also, Sesame Street.
And we also have the Turkish accent from Dominic Cooper. He's doing a brilliant Turkish accent. So, you know, too many accents can get in the way. So, it didn't feel necessary to give him one of those. I'm sorry to upset you, but
I kind of wanted a Welsh accent as well.
Okay, well, I'll dub it.
Thank you so
much. I'll dub it in Welsh for you.
For the Blu-ray release.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes the world no longer needs a hero. Sometimes what it needs is a monster. Is that good? See, that's what they needed in that trailer. You know, that'd have got him in.
Stalking Newport.
I'm sure there's a couple of monsters in Newport.
So last time I spoke to you was on Ben Wheatley's High Rise a few weeks ago.
Yes,
which just looks fantastic. That's going to come out next year, isn't it?
Yeah. Early next year, I think. Yeah.
And that one, you are playing a Welsh monster.
Yes. Yeah, that's one way to describe him. There's a few more I'd like to describe him as. I mean, he's some he is a character. I mean, far removed from anything I've ever done, and I guess that was the attraction in the first place, to, you know, really shock myself as much as everybody else on the set as to what I could do with his character. And I was, I mean, it's difficult to explain him, really, because he's called the Agitator in the book. But he's an observer, and
What, Vlad the Agitator?
No. We're on about Richard Wilder in Vlad the Agitator. Yeah, he could be. He's an agitator too. He's an aggravator. He's aggravated. No, but Richard Wilder is this. He's the sanest person in the building, covered in a cloak of craziness.
Sold.
But it's interesting to say that this is a role, Richard Wilder, that in which you've done things you've never done before on screen. Given that over the last few years alone, we haven't seen it yet, but you're about to shoot at the dragon with a big arrow. You've played Bard the Bowman, Dracula. You've taken on the Fast and Furious team as well, Clash the Titans. This is not a bad little CV for, as you say, just 6 years.
Yeah. My God. God, yeah, you just reminded
me. You've crammed a lot in.
Yeah. I feel old all of a sudden.
Can I ask how it feels to be Jason Statham's brother?
Quite cool, actually, yeah. If ever I'm in a sticky situation, I'm just going to call him up and say, listen, I know you're not really my brother, but do you fancy just coming up and standing up for me a minute?
Yeah, I'm just having a chat with Christopher Lee and things are getting out of hand.
Yeah, could you come and give him a wallop, yeah.
Yeah, we've had too many sherries.
Yeah. No, Statham's great. He's a great man. He's very fun, and he's good to work with. I've worked with him twice now, so it's fun. And he's cool. Wouldn't you want Jason Statham to be your older brother?
You have no idea.
Constantly, you know, defending you and pulling you out of sticky situations. Perfect brother to have. Yeah, he doesn't have much trouble with girls, does he?
Yeah, no, he doesn't. No.
On that note, Luke, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
Thank you.
I enjoy the way you say Dracula.
Is that how they say it in the film?
No.
Oh.
Yeah, of course they do. A Draculia.
Draculia.
I am Draculia.
There's at least two extra consonants in there.
I am Draculia until
there. I'm very peculiar. Yeah. I'm peculiar, Draculia.
I spell it Drac
L-I-E-R. That's Draculia. What I'm hearing.
So that was Luke Evans. What a lovely man.
Isn't he?
I've
got a lovely photograph of lovely him with lovely me, and he is lovely and tall, but he decided to stoop to conquer, and he nuzzled in, and he looks shorter than me, so now I look good.
He nuzzled in? Did he nuzzle in?
With his hands. Can you nuzzle with your hands?
I don't remember there being any nuzzling.
He wasn't nuzzling you, maybe.
No.
It's getting pretty hot and steamy in this booth.
I think he...
Right, we'll be reviewing Dracula Untold later on in the podcast.
Are they going to rename it to Dracula Told once it's out? You really should.
Dracula Unseen.
Maybe for the Blu-ray and DVD.
That's Dracula Told.
Yeah. Let's talk some movie news now, shall we?
No.
Okay, yay. Let's move on to the second guest. He's a man I've long... No, okay, let's do some movie news. Custom dictates. The format we arbitrarily imposed ourselves 131 episodes ago dictates that we must do movie news now.
I think we have a tendency to start with a news story that's actually of interest. I want to start with something that has no interest to anybody at all.
Okay.
Set the mood, yeah.
I tweeted this with the words... The Angry Birds movie reveals its voice cast continues to be a thing. Yes, the Angry Birds movie has no sign in any way of deciding to stop.
Well, it feels like this should have been out years ago, shouldn't it? I mean, Angry Birds...
There was an article like 2 days ago saying that they dropped 60 million users over the past couple of years.
Yes.
They still have 200 million users worldwide.
I'll admit, there was a point where I was into Angry Birds and I was playing it quite a bit, and I even bought the board game for someone as a gift. There's quite a fun game where you get an actual catapult and you fling stuff at other stuff.
Yeah.
I haven't even thought about Angry Birds for... It just seems this is... taken a long time to get together, but you know, maybe that's because they've been working on the script, working on it, getting it perfect
and working.
Well, I think one of the reasons why, if I'm right in thinking, the cast names were revealed by people playing the game, so that once they actually, is this right, once players playing the game blasted a billion blocks, is that right, destroyed a billion birds or through,
I think,
or
it was the billion,
it was a billion birds,
the, yeah.
Good to see we're on top of this story, but anyway.
Which one's the pig? Anyway, so the aim of the game is to fling birds, of course, explosive suicidal bomber birds.
Some of them, not
suicide
all.
Bomber birds, not bomber birds. Suicide bomber birds at a poorly constructed brick/wooden house, which has some pigs inside, which are, of course, green.
You're oversimplifying something, which is actually very complex.
You're right. Sorry. I'm just going to read out the press release because...
As I was writing the news story about this, I just didn't know how to do it justice. Here it is.
Okay.
Jason Sudeikis.
Yes, we like him.
Will lead the cast as Red, a bird with a temper problem, as opposed to all the other birds. Josh Gad, in his first animated role since Frozen.
Oh, mention Frozen.
Plays Speedy Chuck.
Yes.
And Danny McBride.
We like him.
Portrays the volatile Bomb.
Oh, he's so volatile.
Bill Hader.
Yes, we like him.
Has joined the Pork Side.
Ooh.
Oh.
Maya Rudolph.
Is that meant to be like Dark Side?
Will play Matilda.
Yeah. Who's Matilda? I don't remember a Matilda in the game.
Peter Dinklage.
We like him.
Will play the legendary Mighty Eagle.
Yes. Do you have to pay for him to appear in the movie?
Earmarked for a July.
That was a very clever the first joke,
2016 right. release in the US. Angry Birds is directed by two relatively unknown.
Do you think they came veterans. Up with this voice cast by flinging birds at people in Hollywood, seeing who they hit?
Can I answer that question honestly?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
I think this is a really good cast.
Very good cast.
And I do like the idea that you have to pay. Dinklage is the first ever in movie purchase. You have to, if the movie's not good enough for you, you pay 69p and he shows up in your screening.
You
have to do it for the Mighty Eagle you see in the game. You have to pay money in the game to get the Mighty Eagle. Oh my god, people.
Peter Dinklage has been getting a bit of flack recently. Have you heard about this? This hot new game, Destiny, which he voices a kind of robot sidekick. And there's been a lot of talk about how his voice performance is not very good. So it's going to be interesting to see.
Wait, hang on. Are you telling me that somewhere out there people are criticising Peter Dinklage?
Yeah.
This will not stand. Yeah.
If he literally did it over a phone, then that may have been a bad
That's
move.
That's what is being speculated. There is a YouTube video, which is a compilation of all the line deliveries. It's quite entertaining.
I heard that one of the lines he says in the game is, I have to say what?
Well, the dialogue is not great in the first place, so I'm not sure it's entirely his fault. But anyway, it's interesting that he's coming back and doing more voice stuff.
He's also appearing in another game-related movie called...
Game of... What's happening?
Have we forgotten, or are you just building up tension? I don't... Pixels.
Yeah, okay. Pixels! That's it!
Okay.
Oh, you ruined it.
Damn
you
it.
Ruined the delayed release. Well, he plays a super gamer, super arcade gamer, who teams up with none other than Adam Sandler, I will neatly segue with and into beautiful. And onto with Nick's story, which involves somebody called Adam Sandler.
I do like a slick segue.
Well... Allow me to ruin it. Yes, like ancient soothsayers of yore, we have predicted the future. We have been running an extended feature online, on Empire Online, about the future of cinema, the future of everything, really. I don't think that's stating it too much.
We've talked about lasers, we've talked about piracy, we've talked about women.
It's amazing. There's tons of amazing stuff. Go and check it out. But one of the predictions was that Netflix are going to move into making films, not just showing them. And it has come true. Very quickly, because Netflix are going to be creating 4 movies. That's the good news.
Tell me, Nick, what are the amazing movies that we can get excited about for Netflix?
Well, they've worked with the likes of David Fincher and Kevin Spacey. Great talents. So we're going to get 4 Adam Sandler movies.
Wait, what?
Yeah, 4 Adam Sandler
movies. Record scratch.
We don't have titles, we don't have plots. They may not end up with plots.
I don't think they need either of those things.
But I have a statement from Adam Sandler.
I think I would watch a movie called Adam Sandler Netflix Movie 1.
Please actually read this statement. I feel like I know what's coming here.
Yeah, and it's like one of those statements. He hasn't given his demands yet, but there must surely be a way of stopping this. Okay, so Adam Sandler has said, when these fine people came to me with an offer to make 4 movies for them, I immediately said yes for one reason and one reason only. Netflix rhymes with wet chicks. Let the streaming begin.
See, there's 2 jokes in there. Yeah. Already he's given them 2 jokes for free.
Can we go back to punchable movie characters? Little Nicky could get a punch, and I tell you more than him is Billy Madison.
Oh god, yes.
Could get
punch him.
A big fat punch.
I love Adam Sandler, but maybe overstating it. I quite like Adam Sandler.
I have loved Adam Sandler. Overstating.
I have loved Adam Sandler movies in the past. And I will continue to do so in the future.
You are a That's My Boy apologist.
I am a That's My Boy apologist. I absolutely...
I tried watching that on Netflix at your behest because you had been trying to convince me that it was good.
Yes.
I made it about 10 minutes in.
But let's not forget, of course, that it's not just Adam Sandler movies that he's been in. His man has produced so many great American classics. Deuce Bigelow would not exist without Adam Sandler. I'm undermining my argument here, aren't I? Joe Dirt would not exist without Adam Sandler. I'll be quiet now.
Wow, things are really like falling apart for you right now.
That one really went badly.
Pop trivia quiz.
Yes.
What is the name of Adam Sandler's
production company.
Happy Madison.
Yes.
Helen, you get 5 points.
Thank you.
Anyway, let's not turn this into a big piling up on Adam Sandler, because you know you don't have to watch his films. The exciting thing here is that genuinely the news that Netflix are making their own movies.
And they're also doing Crouching Tiger, which is a Winnie the Pooh spin-off. Hidden Dragon 2.
Which Helen will love because it's got a hidden dragon in it.
It's true.
Which is shooting at the moment in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Our old friend of the magazine, Bay Logan, is one of the producers. And it's being shot, directed by the martial arts choreographer of the Matrix films.
Awesome.
But the interesting thing about this and the Adam Sandler thing is what it makes, what it'll do for the distribution model going forward. Because already Netflix have announced this week that they will be releasing Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2 on Netflix on the same day that it hits IMAX cinemas in the US. Now, this is something that's been happening for a while, I guess. VOD, lots of movies are getting cinematic releases in the States and over here. You can download films now on your Skybox. Some films on your Skybox the same day that they're in cinemas. They came together as a fairly recent example. But cinema companies in the States, and I believe Cineworld in Europe, have said that we're not going to take Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2 as a sign of protest over this.
Yeah,
they're cannibalizing our business.
They're trying to preserve the traditional 12-week window. Yes. There have been rumblings about this before. If you remember, I think it was Alice in Wonderland. They tried to get that out on DVD and Blu-ray within the 12-week window. And
before,
some cinema chains...
Before people came to their senses.
Some cinema chains refused to show it as a result. So there may be elements of that still going on. I think, listen, we're in a time of flux in terms of distribution, so I think there's going to be more flux. But it is interesting to see Netflix. But it is interesting to see Netflix put so much skin in the game.
I was going to say, well, we actually had Ted Sarandos, who's the president of Netflix, come into our offices. When was this? About last year sometime? About a year ago. He came in and we had a big meeting with him. He was just talking about how Netflix is the future. And we asked him, would Netflix move into film production? He said, maybe. You never know. But, they haven't yet said which model they're going to adapt. But a lot of people assume that Netflix are there to blow cinema out of the water and that these Adam Sandler movies will be released. You know, maybe they're going to be released altogether, like a House of Cards season. All at the same time, 4 Adam Sandler movies at once. Oh, that'd be amazing. But perhaps they are.
You've just got me thinking because of that latest season of Arrested Development. What if one of the movies, all 4 movies are the same story, but one of them is told from...
Seth Rogen's point of view.
Yeah, Kevin James. One of them is Kevin James. One of them is Rob Schneider. One of them is
so
Adam Sandler. One of them is David Spade.
It's like Growing Ups 3, but it's split.
But like also like Rashomon.
Films.
Well, the Growing Upsy verse is huge potential, I think. But are they going to be showing these films in cinemas as well? They haven't announced yet. They haven't said for sure. We all assume that we're just going to be able to watch them on our phone or on our TV. We won't have to go to the cinema. But I'm not so sure. I think Sarandos said that they're not out to destroy the cinematic experience in that meeting. I'm paraphrasing a guy who said something to us a year ago, but I'll be very interested to see where they go with this.
I think they're going to have to show in theatres at some point, aren't they? I mean, if you're going to try and get a director like David Fincher, who Netflix already have a relationship with, if they're going to try and lure him into doing stuff with them, he's going to want his films in the theatre. And it's interesting that these are 4 comedies, which I imagine most Adam Sandler fans enjoy going out, see it on the big screen.
They said specifically they're comedies. no, because there's a guy who,
Chris wants a guarantee, damn it.
Well, we haven't had one yet, but...
Come on now.
They keep promising.
By the way, David Fincher has agreed to shoot all of the
first
season.
What if David Fincher is doing these films?
That'd be amazing. He's agreed to do all of the first season of the US remake of Utopia for HBO. Yes. Not just the first 2 episodes like he did for House of Cards. So much so that now some wag on the Empire Online comments section was saying that because he's remaking this stuff, he should be called David Pincher because he's stealing things.
He's stealing, that's good.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's
like
really
it.
Good. While we're talking about release models and cinema and box office and all that sort of stuff, very maybe potentially interesting story this weekend, that at the UK box office, for the first time ever, this weekend, you know those things where you can go see a theatre play, you can see a play, but they broadcast, they film it, they broadcast it around cinemas, or they broadcast a Robbie Williams concert, or whatever it is that they do.
Yeah, and this is a live one.
A live one. Yeah. Of Billy Elliot. There was a big mashup of Billy Elliot, a big celebration on Sunday, and it was a one-off broadcast around cinemas around the country, and it topped the UK box office. It made 1.9 million in its one one little showing around the country and beat The Equalizer.
Just to clarify, that's Billy Elliot the musical, which is on at the moment in London. It was celebrating its 10th anniversary, and they reunited all the Billies.
Yes, they did.
Our Ali Wybury went to see it.
Yeah. Indeed. Chris and I went to see when it opened.
We did.
She said there was lots of dancing.
That's right, Helen. I do remember you and I were there at the Billy Elliot's opening.
Yeah, and we definitely didn't cry during the bit where his mum's letters read out. Definitely.
No, I didn't cry.
Sure.
I genuinely didn't cry. I was too busy trying to punch him. And he's punched.
Helen, do you have another news story?
Yes, I do. Thank God. I have the news of a reboot, because we live in the 21st century and we cover news from Hollywood. The reboot this time is the post-apocalyptic thriller I Am Legend, which was, of course, the semi adaptation of Richard Matheson's amazing sci-fi slash horror classic. That one starred Will Smith. It was a huge success around the world. They talked about doing a prequel. They talked about doing a sequel. It now seems they've given up on all that, and they're just going to reboot the entire thing. So they have a spec script. It's a completely different project by a guy called Gary Graham, who wrote A Garden at the End of the World. And they're going to turn that into a reboot of Richard Matheson's original story. So that it was, of course, the story of a lone guy left in a world where a virus has killed most people but turned a minority of people into sort of ravenous vampire-like creatures. There, the similarities between I Am Legend and the movie I Am Legend pretty much end. It remains to be seen how much this will, you know, stick close to the book, or how much it will follow the Will Smith model. I didn't hate the I Am Legend movie, I should say. Like, it was fine. It just wasn't even remotely the Richard Matheson story. And the Richard Matheson story, especially in the third act, has a much, much better ending.
I think they should cast Jaden.
No, don't even say it.
In the reboot.
Gosh, we're getting back to punchability, aren't we?
But introduce Twitter into the story. If you've not seen Jaden Smith's Twitter feed...
It's amazing.
It's avant-garde.
You should look at the Jaden Smith's Twitter feed as Garfield cartoons list. Incredible. The things he says are just like, I have no future, there is fashion. And then you see Garfield go, huh?
This, of course, is a story that's been remade several times. Yes. Big screen I Am Legend was just the third
recent
incarnation.
Yeah. Billy Madison.
Billy Madison. Yeah. I Am Gilmore. All those films. So I'm not against that in a way. It'd be nice for him to finally get it right, even though I've got a soft spot for the Omega Man, but it's too soon, isn't it? On the other hand, they used I Am Legend to soft launch Batman v Superman, didn't they? So I wonder what else what other films that this movie might be able to predict.
Talking,
that's a slow burn marketing campaign, isn't it?
I'd like to see a remake of Soylent Green. That's a film I just watched a few weeks ago, and it's a really great film. It's very dated now. But if you're going to remake, you know, one of those classic sci-fi stories, why not do that, which hasn't been seen since the 70s?
I watched about 12 episodes of The Fresh Prince last weekend, because I'm into 1990s shit. I was thinking it would be great to have Will Smith come back. His career is not in the best spot right now. Why doesn't he come back and do the not-so-Fresh Prince, where he's a bit old, and it's the same...
He was a zombie. He's rotting.
He's a zombie living in their house.
Yes.
That's so good.
He's sent to Bel-Air because he's a zombie. Mm. And he goes to live with his uncle and aunt in Bel-Air because his uncle is the world's foremost zombie expert.
Perfect. Uncle Phil, zombie expert.
Yeah.
This is genius. Anyway, so copyright me and you, Chris.
Obviously. If you're listening, Ted Sarandos, we would like to just come back in and have another meeting with us, and we can just, you know, put a piece of paper for you to sign. It's not a contract. It's not legally binding or anything, but thank you for the house. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I'd like to see that. Why are we watching lots of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
You know why.
I know why, but I'm going to get you to say it.
I have I wouldn't call it a rival podcast, but I have a podcast to do with my friend Ross, which is just watching 1990s TV shows called 1990s Problems. And we spend about an hour of time talking about the likes of Bucky O'Hare and...
brilliant.
And Biker Mice from Mars, and most recently Fresh Prince.
And you're way more drunk in that than you are in this.
I was absolutely blotto in the last one. But yeah, it's... Fresh Prince really stands up. If you haven't watched any recently, go and watch one called 72 Hours, where Carlton becomes part of the Hood and dresses up as a pirate. It's amazing.
So the prospect of Ali Plum sober excites you, and the prospect of Ali Plum drunk must knock your socks off. Go and download 1990s Problems.
Could mention very quickly that Ben Affleck has added another film to his to-do list. He's already, of course, on Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. He's planning to direct Live by Night, another Dennis Lehane adaptation, but he is also apparently contemplating a role in The Accountant. What's wonderful about this is it comes from the writer of The Judge, who will presumably be following this up with, you know,
The Doctor.
Exactly, and The Tax Attorney. And
The Horse Surgeon.
Yeah, The Tree Surgeon.
Nope.
That's a film I would watch.
Yeah, okay. The Podcaster.
That's not a real profession. But yes, it's apparently about a mild-mannered office-type accountant who is a secret assassin.
Well, we could mention that, Helen, but I don't think we got the time.
Oh, so shame. Sorry.
Maybe next week.
Okay.
Okay, that's it for the movie news. And time now for our second guest. He's a man I've long been wanting to talk to in this very pod booth, in this very seat. For not only is he Dr. Alan Grant, he's also Dr. William Weir, the inventor of the Event Horizon. So naturally, I was away when the great Sam Neill came into the pod booth to talk about his movie work and his return in the second series of Stephen Knight's period thriller, Peaky Blinders. Peaky Blinders, which started back on BBC Two this week, earning my eternal envy by getting to interview the Kiwi legend where Nick and Helen enjoy
Neill before Sam.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you're back for more Peaky Blinders in season
Yes,
two.
We've just finished. We were I was in Manchester for about 6 weeks, and everyone else was there for about 10 weeks, I think.
What can we expect for Campbell this year? Because your character had just a fascinating arc last season, where he came in as the sort of the righteous man who was going to sort everybody out, and gradually some serious cracks began to show in that facade.
Yeah, well, that's what's so great about him. I mean, he's so rotten and ghastly and beastly. But, you know, like every good villain, he has a human dimension, and he's vulnerable, and bad things happen. And here's the coffee. How lovely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Unfortunately, I think he gets badder this time. It does some unspeakable things. It's been such a lot of fun.
So bad guys do have more fun.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the devil gets all the best lines, you know.
I mean, it's been compared to a kind of a British Deadwood, which I thought was a really interesting comparison and seemed to fit better than most things. I mean, Boardwalk Empire as well is sort of between the two, but it has got a little bit of weirdly frontier spirit to it, and just sort of, you know, that kind of edge.
Otto, who was the original director, always had the Western in mind. Loves classic Westerns. Mm. He's now doing something in Texas, so perhaps he's doing a real Western. I don't know. But
getting it out of his system.
Yeah.
But there's something fantastic about seeing that style applied to Birmingham. It's pretty rare that that happens. Had you been to Birmingham much before?
No, I've been to Birmingham once, and I got lost on the Bull Ring or whatever it's called, and I thought, this is disturbing. I didn't shoot anything of this in Birmingham. We shot it all in Leeds, Liverpool, and Manchester. I'm not quite sure why that is. I think they either the Luftwaffe or the Birmingham City Council made sure that there's very little heritage building there, perhaps. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, maybe everyone was getting lost on the same road that you got lost on.
That's right. There's still a crew revolving, looking for some actors.
You have a terrific website. Really, really fun. And it looks like the place where you live.
Hmm.
Is this amazing farm? Would you describe it as a farm?
Yes. Well, I'm two paddocks is actually four little vineyards, but the main one, which is called Red Bank, we're not purely monoculture. We have pigs and sheep and cows and orchards and vegetable gardens, and we grow saffron and lavender, that sort of thing. So it's sort of holistic how we approach things. The cows are completely just live on the land. All they do is crap, actually. That's because we farm very organically and biodynamically. We use a lot of those techniques. And it's important. My vineyard manager assures me that only cow shit will do.
Noted.
That's right.
Something I learned from your Twitter account is that you have a chicken named Sean Connery.
Yes. Sean's gone missing, and I'm concerned about him. He's either abandoned me for tax exile, or he's been taken by a feral cat. I don't know.
Blimey.
Yeah.
We'll put some posters up.
Yeah, hopefully the former.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. He's living the life in the Bahamas playing golf. A golf-playing chicken.
You have this kind of thing where you name animals after... Are they actors that you've worked with or actors you admire? Or?
Yeah, it's a bit random. The biggest cow is called Lady Kane. It's a beautiful cow. I've met Shakira Kane, who's Michael's wife, a few times, and I thought she was probably the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. Mm. So I named the cow after her. And the second biggest cow is called Gong Li, named after the great Chinese actress who I met in a lift once. And I thought, my God, that's an incredibly beautiful woman and a wonderful actor. So it's quite a compliment from my side.
Do they always see it as...
But my wife is completely horrified. She's worked with Gong Li. She said, you cannot call a cow after Gong Li. She'll be so upset and I'll never work in the industry again. So I don't know. I'm hoping, you know, not too much offence is taken, but it's meant well.
Do you name your pigs after people as well?
One of my pigs is called Ginger. It's named after the butcher in Marylebone. It's called Ginger Pig. So I don't say the name aloud in her company. Yeah, it's a bit random. There's a new pig called Bruce, but he was pre-named. Bruce is the latest sow. The biggest sow is called Poots, after Imogen Poots.
Oh, yes.
Who's a good pal.
You, of course, worked with quite recently.
She was delighted to be called after a pig. I said, you're going to have a pig or a cow? She said, I'll take the pig.
Oh, excellent.
And but Poots has got a new boyfriend called Bruce, Bruce is an enormous black pig the size of this studio, and they're having a honeymoon together as we speak.
Oh.
Bruce is a lively lad. Mm. I don't know if you know about the sex lives of pigs, but it's...
Not as much as I'd like.
I can tell you they're at it for the duration.
Excellent. We've learned something today.
Well, I tell you what, I've learned so much on this trip. There was a wonderful thing on Wales on BBC Four the other day. I love BBC Four. Mm. And it was about sex and violence in the whale world, not something you expect to see at 9 o'clock on BBC Four. But the right whale, which is a very big whale, it's twice the size of a humpback, is a very, very... what's the word? It's a very promiscuous whale. And they had this fantastic footage of whale orgies. Mm. I do recommend it.
That sounds like that should be on later than 9 o'clock.
Yes, and Yes, I think you're right. Who's up at 9 o'clock?
Dean Spanley is an interesting film. You play a vicar who was once a dog, if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, Dean Spanley is a film I'm very, very fond of, and it kind of connects into my wine world too. And I got to know... I'd actually worked on two or three things with Peter O'Toole prior to that, but as is the way of film, we'd never actually been in the same room at the same time. But I got to know Peter very well on that, and it was a great privilege to work with him. He was a lovely man and just a fantastic actor. Mm. And just being with him for 5 minutes was a masterclass in screen acting in itself.
Which other actors are real wine buffs that you can have a very detailed conversation about wine with?
Well, there's a great deal of alcohol buffs.
Right.
I'm not sure about wine buffs so much. Let's see, who's...
I mean, there's Francis Ford Coppola. Have you met him?
No, I don't know Francis at all. Mm. Liam Neeson, who's a friend of mine, is a great imbiber of my wine and buys it by the caseload, which is always very gratifying. He is, at the moment, absolutely dry. He's not having a drink.
Okay.
It's probably a good
thing.
Bad
for your business. You've taken some losses in the fourth quarter.
That's my single biggest client. This is a concern. And he loves his wine. There's quite a lot of people I know that really are into it.
I wanted to ask you about Hunt for Red October, because I believe it's an incredible film, and it's still one that's really celebrated, but it was a tough shoot for you, wasn't it?
It was an odd shoot, because it's the only time in my life that I've worked in a completely male environment. It was the most weird thing. We were locked up in this submarine set for most of the time. All the crew of the submarine were male. All the crew of the film were male, even makeup and hair and wardrobe and things. So it was like being in a sort of sweaty locker room. It was summer, you know, it was on the stage at Paramount, and I found it really weird. There was too much testosterone on the set altogether, you know. But I enjoyed it, and we had 2 days at sea, me and Sean. Sham! Good morning, Sham! On top of the conning tower of the submarine. That was quite fun.
That's how the movie opens, doesn't it, with the two of you up there?
Yeah.
And you got to go in a real atomic submarine with Tim Curry.
Absolutely, yeah.
That must be... How was that? Apparently you guys were the only people who volunteered to do it.
That's right, yeah. And we had... and this is before 9/11, you wouldn't be allowed near it now. But it was a real nuclear submarine, and we were underwater for 48 hours. It was fantastic, an amazing opportunity. I did learn one or two things there, which I can probably... at the risk of being shot as a spy by the US State Department, there are places in the front of a submarine. We're taken all everywhere, but there were places in the submarine where there were 24-hour Marines with machine guns, and you cannot go beyond that spot. I don't know what is up the front of the submarine. I'd tell you if I knew, but you weren't allowed to go. It was no-go area.
Wow.
Maybe that's where they keep the Ark of the Covenant to transport it. I wanted to ask about The Dish, which is a film that I think not enough people saw, but it's one of the nicest stories that I've ever seen.
Rob Sitch, who directed it, it comes out of a cooperative of comedians, actually, in Melbourne. Principally, they're comedians. And they do television series, they do movies. They'd done a film prior to that called The Castle, which has got quite a following. And Rob, who I knew slightly, he called me up and he said, I want to come up and see, I'm sending the script. We'd like you to play the part of the scientist, the main scientist at The Dish. It's a story we like very much. And I read it straight away and I thought, that's terrific, I'll do that. I called him up. And I said, you don't need... He said, I'll be there at 3 o'clock. I said, Rob... And hung up. And we went out to the garden, my garden in Sydney. We're there for 2 hours. I said, Rob, here's a cup of tea. I'm going to tell you... He said, let me tell you what happens. I really want you... I said, Rob, I'm going to do the film. And 2 hours later, he was still talking me into it. I don't know why he couldn't take yes for an answer, but anyway... He talks himself around and myself around, and I was very pleased to do it.
It's just a really feel-good, kind of a heartwarming little story. It was lovely.
Sam, I wanted to ask you about a story. I think it is my favourite story about you that I've heard. It's by, I was told it by Costa Botez, who did Forgotten Silver with Peter Jackson. Mm. And he told a story about you being honoured at a ceremony and Peter Jackson making a video in which your house gets blown up.
Yes.
Can you share that story with us from your perspective?
They were honouring me in Los Angeles, and they asked Peter to come and give me the thing. And he said, "Look, I can't do it. I'm editing Lord of the Rings, but I'll make a little film for you instead." So I was kind of quite astounded that, because I had a little house in Wellington above his house, and I've got it on a videotape somewhere. I must commit it to something. It's not quite so. I'm vulnerable, but it's a great old film. It starts with Peter in a car, and he says, "Hi, Sam. I'm just waving to you from Wellington, and we miss you very much. And there's your house up there. And I thought we'd just go up and have a look at the house and see that everything's in order. And I know you haven't been there for a while, and you know it. The camera travels with." Peter's talking all the way, and then he pulls up in front of the house and he does double take and says, "Oh my God, I think there's people in there." And he jumps out of the car, the camera rushes in behind him, and indeed there are a bunch of thugs in there. He's completely indignant. He says, what do you think you're doing there? This is Sam Neill's house. How dare you? Oh my God, is that human waste on the floor? And they basically tell him to fuck off, and Peter in terror retreats to the car, reverses like crazy up the street, and then you cut to a wide shot of the whole hillside and the harbour, and there's my house up on the ridge, and poof, it explodes. Peter's torched my house. That's very good. Actually, and all the thugs who look really alarming work for Peter at... everyone works for Peter and Wade.
That's amazing. Did you ever get him back?
No, but I plan to, yeah. It's only a matter of time.
When he least expects it. Mm. Excellent.
It's one of those kind of casting close call rumours that circulates the internet, is that you were nearly in Lord of the Rings. Can you say anything about that? Or
they were nice enough to offer me a part in it, and I'd love to have done it. But I was actually doing, I think it was Jurassic 3 at the time. So
wow, not a bad substitute, I guess.
So there was no question. But they do take a long time to shoot. You know, you're very poor at the end of it. there's a few of my friends are hobbits as well.
Okay.
And they turned up for the last one and they discovered to their complete alarm that they're there for 3 years. They thought it was like 3 months. Still, there are worse places to be stuck than Wellington.
I think we have to wrap up here, but Chris Hewitt, one of our colleagues, would never forgive us if we didn't talk about Event Horizon, which is one of his favourite films.
Is it?
It genuinely is. He quotes it all the time, and particularly your "Do you see" line. Is that a film you have fond memories of, or is that one that was a tough one?
It was quite tough, especially when they when I turn into a something really really hideous. And I had this sort of all this rubber stuff on me. My genitals had been ripped out, you know.
It
was nice, and I was covered in blood. It would take 8 hours to get all that prosthetics and blood on me, standing mostly.
Oof.
I'd start at 2 a.m. and I'd be ready at 10 a.m. Mm. And on that freezing Bond stage, which I think burnt down, no great loss there. I hated it. I hated that stage, but it was fun doing that film. You know, Fishburne's a good friend, Sean Pertwee, people like that. You know, they're good lads.
It does have a cult following in our office.
Does it?
It's mostly Chris, but he does quote your lines all the time. And I think we have to let you go, Sam. But thank you very much,
and I hope that
Sean Connery the Chicken makes an appearance.
Let's hope. Come back, Sean. All is forgiven, and we'll pay your tax for you.
Thank you very much.
But on last week's podcast, did I explain the secret to a William Weir impression?
No, I don't think you did.
The secret to a William Weir impression is that you start low and then you go high. Do you see? With every sentence.
Can you hear the people sing?
Yes, I'd like a cheeseburger. That sort of thing. Right, so was he nice? He was good.
He was a delight. Yeah.
He was lovely. There was that whip in the middle where he ripped his eyeballs out, but otherwise a delight.
I would have liked to have seen Montana.
That's sad.
That is sad, isn't it? All right, time now for this week's reviews. We're going to start with Gone Girl, David Fincher's adaptation of Gillian Flynn, her best-selling novel starring Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike.
PK.
But first, a heads up. We've put together a spoiler special podcast for the movie featuring an interview with Fincher himself, David Fincher himself, and that is available as of Monday, October...
6th.
Monday's the 6th?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. So download that and then go there for all your spoiler needs, because this is obviously a film we have to tiptoe around plot-wise, because there's a huge twist in the middle of the film where you find out she's not gone at all, she's just Soylent Green.
Ah! Oh, Chris.
Damn it. But what are the bits we can talk about? Helen, our very own here girl.
Thank you.
Okay.
So this is obviously an adaptation of the best-selling book. I'm sure lots of you will have read it, but for those who haven't, I'm going to try and be very careful, because, as you will know if you have read it, it's a film of changes. You change perspective between the characters. You change sympathies in terms of who you're kind of rooting for in this affair. And it does become a situation where you are deciding who exactly you are rooting for, who exactly you can trust, and who exactly is to be believed at all. So Ben Affleck is Nick Dunn. He is a kind of slightly feckless guy. He seems basically fine. Comes home one day after spending the morning out of the house and finds scenes of disruption and his wife gone. Now, he tries to keep calm. He calls the police, but doesn't make, you know, doesn't go completely hysterical and kind of overreact. He's trying to kind of be the sensible guy. And then things begin to look as if he may have been the one responsible for her disappearance. And certainly he becomes public enemy number one. In the court of public opinion, you know, it's very clear that he's the guy that they're all sort of pointing the fingers at. And it becomes a film about both the past of their relationship, which we see through Amy's diary entries, as well as through Nick's account of their relationship. And it becomes a story of, you know, perception, how we present ourselves to the outside world, how we present ourselves to each other, even the people we're closest to, and how much of ourselves we maybe hide behind the surface. And I think that's true of, you know, certainly the two main characters in this film, in Amy and Nick, and indeed of, you know, many of the peripheral characters as well. Everybody has secrets. It's a pretty cynical film in many ways, I think, in terms of the way it looks at people's relationships. And at the same time, it's a very, very funny film, but it's a really pitch black kind of comedy. I mean, this is not a comfortable film in many ways. I think it's it probably wouldn't hurt as a first date movie. It's a terrible anniversary movie, as I think we've been talking about in The Office. I think that was your line, Chris.
No, it was James's line.
Oh, I apologise.
It was James's line. I'm looking forward to seeing this with my wife, actually. I'll be watching her very closely all the way through, using my secret night vision goggles. Is that creepy?
A little bit.
Okay.
Well, that you have a wife?
Yeah. Does anyone believe that?
I'm still convinced.
Do you believe that?
Yeah.
She's very convincing, the model I've, the actress I've played.
The real life decoy.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people are going to not enjoy this film.
Really?
Why? I think a lot of people are going to be wound up by it, and it pushes you away in a kind of Finchery, deal with it, fashion. I really like it. I found myself fascinated by what was going on. And it has, maybe the other thing is it has a pulp storyline that zags and zigs. And sometimes if you give it too much thought, there are holes you can push into it.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think it's a movie that you have to let that sort of thing go over you, because it's not about that. It's about the media and about relationships, and it's about how we pretend to be other people and how we try to live up to expectations and. I think there's a lot in this film. I think the reason why we're doing a spoiler podcast about something that isn't necessarily, hey, did you catch that reference, or, oh, look, that's referring to a book, is telling. There is a lot going on here, and I think this is a movie that's very zeitgeisty. I think a lot of people are going to go and watch this film. I think a lot of people want to talk about this movie. As soon as I left it, I watched it with you, Helen, and we were both going, what about this? What about this? Could it be read this way? Could it be read that way? Do you think Finch is trying to say this? Do you think the actor was delivering in this manner? Are you team this or team that? Like, it was... there's a lot in it, but at the same time, it is also somehow shallow because of the despicableness of the characters. I would say that you'll find it difficult to fully connect with a lot of people, and if you find yourself becoming frustrated with movies because you can't connect with an individual character as well as you'd like to, I know there are guys out there, I have friends who find that frustrating. Things like Seven Psychopaths, they get a bit pushed away because they can't attach to someone, then that may be a problem. Otherwise, I think it's a very well-made film off a book that seems almost impossible to adapt.
Yeah, I didn't have that problem. I thought this was fantastic. It fits very neatly into Finch's filmography, and I think if you want to do a headfucky triple bill, Seven, The Game, and this have a lot in common, and I can't really explain why, because this isn't the spoiler podcast, but there are various strands with those two films that fit quite nicely into this. I really liked it, and I got very involved. I thought, you know, you're on side with the Ben Affleck character. He's not the nicest of characters, but then again, like Helen was saying, almost everyone in this character is a pretty awful human being in one way or another. It is a very, very cynical film, but also really kind of beautiful one, really beautifully shot. I think the score is amazing. I've just been listening to it on my...
It's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross again.
Yeah. It's pretty similar to the Social Network one in terms of the vibe of it, but it's really, really great. It fits the visuals perfectly, and it's beautiful shots. I really liked it, and I really liked the book as well. It's a surprisingly faithful adaptation.
Well, it's scripted by the actual writer, isn't it? Gillian.
So maybe not surprising then. But,
no, but it is surprising because of what I mentioned earlier, is I think this is a book that is written in a diary form or epistolarily written, you know, book. So it's not traditionally this happened, then that happened. It's all about perspectives. It's all about what is he thinking, what is she thinking, what is so-and-so thinking. To convey that through cinema is a very, very difficult thing. It's almost like David Fincher said, well, this will be difficult, I'll do it.
Yeah, and I think Flynn did a very good job of getting rid of parts and cutting things down without cutting things out. There's elements of the book, there's a sort of a marital treasure hunt that they do for their anniversary that has been reduced in scope and reduced in terms of the amount of time it takes up, but not cut out completely, which is, I think, helpful to the plot, because I think it's also quite illuminating about both characters.
Incidentally, we have hidden some Empire magazines on the shelves of Sainsbury's, W.H. Smith, lots of other newsagents. In exchange for tokens that we call £4, you can get one.
And a penny back.
And you get a penny back, because that's a little memento you can keep, as well as the magazine.
You can start saving that towards your next treasure hunt in a month's time.
And this is all to do with the Gone Girl issue we did last month.
That's right.
Wow, I loved that. That was a really clever, shameless plug. I don't know how you snuck that in there. It was very, very good. One thing we haven't talked about with this movie are the performances. Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike to the fore of a very, very good cast, including the likes of Neil Patrick Harris and Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
Who's in it very, very good as a celebrity lawyer called Tanner Bolt. Missy Pyle.
To be honest, the reason I haven't said much about the performances, there's nothing to say beyond, I think they're all really good.
They're all
good.
Very strong. Especially Rosamund Pike.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
It's really tricky to talk about certain performances without treading into spoiler territory, which is why you should download the spoiler podcast, I think. But for me, this is I love this film. I didn't much like the book, I'll
really?
Be honest. Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the book. It's okay, it's a bit of a page turner, it's fine. There's something about, I don't know, was it with the relentless misanthropy of the book that somehow pushed me away, and yet the film's relentless misanthropy lured me in. I don't know what it is. Maybe there's just, I don't know, Fincher's stylings. But I think also the Ben Affleck character is a bit more sympathetic in the film, I think, personally. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting. Who knows? But I thought it was a very, very solid, really mordantly funny. It's very funny.
Yeah, I laughed a lot.
Very funny. In a really dark, twisted sense.
There's a bit involving some yogurt that made me laugh out loud.
It might not be one to go with your folks to, or those of a more sensitive disposition. There are some very dark moments and many uses of the C word.
It's very, very good. It's a worthy addition to Fincher's cinematic oeuvre. So do go and check it out. 4 stars.
That is correct.
4 stars for Gone Girl. There are some flaws, but tiny, tiny little cracks in the ceramic. So, 4 stars for Gone Girl. Do go and see it. Next up, and sorry, Luke Evans, if you're listening, now is the time to put on your earmuffs, for it is time for us to tackle Dracula Untold. Ali.
So there's this guy called Vlad.
Yeah.
And he was a prince of Transylvania. And he was taken by some nasty Turkish folk who kind of oversaw his land. And they made him part of this crack squad of child soldiers, basically. And they whipped him and beat him and turned him into this killing machine. He wore this big dragon armor and was known as the Impaler, because his handy battlefield trick was to get a massive pole and shove it into people's chests and then stab that pole into the ground so that his foe was just wiggling on the top like a fly on the end of a needle. So he's grown up now and he's gone back to Transylvania and is ruling his land peacefully, having a good time. He's got a young child, beautiful wife. He sometimes goes for a walk, sometimes goes for a jog. And he is on one of these walks slash jogs at the beginning of the film where he notices a Turkish helmet in the river.
What?
And the Turkish helmet implies that there's been Turkish that implies that Jason Statham's character from Snatch has been in the area. There have been Turkish scouts in the area. And he's worried that the same thing might happen to his son, that his son might be abducted and put into this soldiering, whipping thing. Blah, 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 blah. He decides to go to the dirty, scary cave where Charles Dance is lurking up in the top of, is it Broken Tooth Mountain? And he is made an offer that he could easily refuse but decides not to, where he can become a vampire and have vampiric powers for 3 days as long as he can resist the urge to drink blood. If he doesn't drink blood, then he will, at the end of that 3-day period, this is all in the terms and conditions, become a normal person again. Until then, he'll have the ability to defend himself against these Turkish folk who are helmed by, or headed up by, one and only Dominic Cooper, who wears a big shiny suit and has a big beard too. So yes, that is the dramatic situation where they try to make Dracula a sympathetic character that becomes a vampire because he needs to, because he has to defend himself and his family and his land against the horde of Turkish, and it really is a horde. There are hundreds of thousands of these people that suddenly arrive, and that's the general setup that I've tried to deliver in a humorous way. It's not that great.
No.
And this isn't because of Luke Evans. He actually really puts his heart and soul into it, and he's very good at it. I like the way he carries off the cape and the sword and the armor, and I believe him when he is this quote-unquote sympathetic character that decides to become this monster, undead monster. But the premise is kind of flawed in of itself at some points. You kind of want him to be a big bad Vlad, but he isn't a big bad Vlad, and you actually want to see more of Charles Dance's Nosferatu-type vampire in the cave, who is actually more of a big bad Vlad. It's about 87 minutes long. It smells a bit of scenes being chopped and chunked out and bits missing. And some, it's myth, and this is a problem I have with a lot of vampire movies recently. It doesn't live up to its myth. It says, these are the rules, and then it breaks them. Or, these are the rules, and then they're a bit twisty. For example, light on the face. There is one scene where it's about how he can't have light on his face, and there is a crack of light across his forehead. And you just go, oh.
Yeah, this is the big attempt to reboot Dracula, really. And it doesn't work. It's one of the most sequel-baiting movies I've seen for a long, long time. Probably since The Losers, which is Jason Patrick's bad guy calling up Jeffrey Dean Morgan's good guy at the end of the movie and saying, see you next time, eh? Eh? Or the A-Team, where they basically run off and it's to say you next time. This has a really sequel-baiting ending. It's never going to happen. This is not going to be a sequel. It's not a dreadful film.
No, I enjoyed it to an extent.
Yeah, it's not awful. And Luke Evans, the reason we had him on the podcast is because we saw the film and we thought, actually, he's really good. He carries the film.
And we love him.
His first proper lead, and he does come out of it well, because he's saddled with a character that makes very tough to make any sense of. But the problem with this is that they're trying to reboot Dracula, and they're trying to reboot Dracula as a romantic hero, and it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It's like, trying to make Darth Vader make any sense, or Hannibal Lecter in some way. It just does not work.
Come on, what girl isn't going to be attracted to a sparkly Luke Evans? I mean, I'm assuming he's sparkly, right? I didn't get to
he
see
he does
the,
not
the
sparkle, except, of course, in a metaphorical sense.
He has a lovely red cape.
Oh, well, you see? What girl can resist a lovely red cape with Luke
he's
Evans
a,
in
he's
it?
He's a dashing warrior. But the problem the film it paints itself into a corner in that Vlad's decision to become a vampire because he saw Charles Dance's character 10 years earlier on, 10 years beforehand, and some of his men were killed by Charles Dance, who's this sort of master vampire who's trapped in a cave, and he can only leave if he gives his powers to someone else, and if they then become a full-blown vampire by drinking someone's blood within 3 days. It's a very, very convoluted plot, but the decision for him to do that just isn't believable at all. I know it's a movie about a man who becomes a vampire, but it's just not believable. And you do get the sense that this has been really hacked to bits by...
On the plus side, there is an amazing sequence that we talked about in the interview where he does have the power to control bats, and he uses it to turn into a massive giant bat fist, and the bat fist punches about 100,000 people, and you go, that is a money shot, and that looks great.
Yeah.
I choose to see this as a spiritual sequel to Last Action Hero, because if you remember, at the end of Last Action Hero, Charles Dance threatens to summon Dracula, and in this movie he creates Dracula.
My word.
So, you know.
Time travel.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Benedict's back.
I mean, speaking of sequel baiting endings, I think we did a feature on that on the website once recently. The Vampire Academy also has an outrageous one, and that's a film that will hopefully never get a sequel.
I'm still waiting for the A-Team 2 with John Hamm. Come on.
Make it happen.
I know, at least people.
Or not.
It's one of those weird films, because it's not a film to hate or despise, but it is, sadly, a bunch of Dracula arse. So,
Dracula arse.
Dracula arse.
It's a load of guano.
It is a load of bat. 2 stars for Dracula Untold. But yes, Luke Evans is very, very good in it indeed.
Bloody shame.
Kevin Costner and sports are usually a good pairing. Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, Tin Cup, for love of the game. So does it remain the case with Ivan Reitman's American football drama, Draft Day?
Yes, it pretty much does, actually. This is obviously an older Costner. This is not a Costner who's going to be out on the football field playing American football. Frankly, he wouldn't necessarily convince us in that role. I know he's a heck of a sportsman. I remember when he made Tin Cup, his golfing coach said he could have, you know, essentially turned pro because he was so good at learning the swing. However, he's not going to convince us as a quarterback because he's a little bit smaller than that and a little bit older. This is him as a manager of the Cleveland Browns, and he gets the chance to trade for the number one pick in the draft. And the draft is, of course, where they take college football players, bring them up into the professional league. It's a huge deal in America. So there's a kind of a consensus number one pick. There's this quarterback that everybody's saying, this is the dude, you need this dude. And he gets the chance, and he's under pressure to kind of make a splash and make his name. His father was a legendary coach, and he's trying to make his own mark in the world, and he's kind of under pressure partly as a result of that. And he basically accepts this trade. He trades like the next 3 year picks for his team to get the number one pick this year, because he's been told by the team owner to make a splash, and then begins to wonder if that was really the right thing to do and if this quarterback is really who he needs. And it's essentially a film about a man on the phone. It's a man on the phone to that quarterback. It's a man on the phone to the team's owner. It's a man in an office talking to the team lawyer, who's also his girlfriend, who's pregnant with his baby. It's a man back on the phone again to managers of other teams, trying to make trades and make deals. It's a man on the phone to other wannabe players like Chadwick Boseman's Vontae Mack, who's really keen to play for the team, and throws into question the real skills of this particular quarterback that he's looking at. So it's a kind of a wheeling dealing story. It shouldn't be interesting, but it really, really is. It's a very human drama. It's quite a small scale affair, but it's just all in, you know, the situation that he's put in, this dilemma of what exactly to do, how to save this maybe not quite ailing team, but certainly underperforming team, and make it into something that can win prizes and you know, match the legendary status that his dad had.
I'm a little annoyed because it sounds like they've found my script for Harry Redknapp the movie and they've made it American.
Yeah.
I just... Because, I mean, were there when he was driving a car and then just wheeled down the window and then talk to people out of the car?
Well, no, there's scenes where he's driving along in the car and listening to sports radio, and they're talking about him, and he looks a little disgruntled.
Okay, they've changed that then.
Yeah, so they've made a few little tweaks to your concept. But honestly, it's actually a very good movie. Good performances from Costner. I don't know American football that well. I don't think this will surprise anyone when I tell you that I don't follow it very closely. But I know enough to be interested in this. It's a kind of a little bit like Moneyball, but I would say better for my money.
I know you're a fan of the Winchester Hunks.
Yes.
They're good.
Who isn't?
Well, they're a great team. I think they've really got a shot this year at the Super Bowl.
Would they be your number one pick?
In the draft?
Why not?
Sure.
Okay. 3 stars then for Draft Day, yep. Which is a recommendation. Also out this week is Life After Beth, which is a rom-com. We've never had one of those before, have we? A rom-com. Have we? I don't recall any.
Well, there might be one.
Oh, you mean Return to the Living Dead Part 3.
Yes, Warm Bodies. Very good.
Yes, very good. Okay. Rom-com starring Aubrey Plaza of Parks and Rec, which is Nick's favourite sitcom, and Dane DeHaan of Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is my favourite sitcom, and we gave that 4 stars. Also out this week, though, probably film of the week in a weird way, although it is Gone Girl, is With Nell and I, the re-release of With Nell and I, which is getting a very limited release in cinemas across the country ahead of its re-release on Blu-ray in a massive, great, big package. So that's amazing. If you've ever gone on holiday by mistake, do go and watch With Nell and I.
It's been 2K-ified and de-dusted and...
Oh, has it?
...touched up and loved and tickled and loved.
Cumberwell-carroted.
It's had a new puff of hash smoke blown all over it.
Mm, amazing. Possibly the most quotable British film of all time?
British film? Well, you are forgetting, sir, Yellowbeard.
I certainly am. And the Python movies as well.
Oh, were they British?
No.
Okay.
And I feel like there might be a rom-com you're forgetting too.
No, I don't think so.
No? Probably not.
That's 10 years old this year? That launched people's careers?
Probably not.
No. Don't think so. Oh, you got red on you, by the way.
Oh,
that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by fast-rising British actress and star of The Maze Runner, Kaya Scodelario, to talk about The Maze Runner, in fact. And schedule permitting, we'll be just a pod standing before Hugh Grant asking him to love us. I'll be wearing my extra-size pants for that one, because Bridget Jones wears big pants. I'll be saying fuck a lot and hitting my alarm clock as well.
Whoopsie daisy.
Whoopsie daisy. Boop. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Mally. It's goodbye from Ellie.
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Nick.
Have a bye.
Bane, welcome to the pod booth.
Hello. Goodbye.
And it is goodbye from me. I'm off to force feed Parks and Recreation to Nick, who is a Parks and Recreation hater.
Parks and Drec.
You bite your tongue.
I quite like it.
All right, I'm going to double team. I'm going to double bill that with Last My Boy. Will see the extra 80 minutes of Last My Boy.
The extra 80 minutes?
You've filmed 80 more minutes.
The Blu-ray extra, which was a film.
Until next week. See you then. Bye.